This is WKAR Online. This week marks the 150th anniversary of the Civil War's bloody battle at Fredericksburg, Virginia. Michigan State University historian Roger Rosentrater helps us remember Michigan's role in the Civil War from time to time. He tells WKAR's Scott Pohl that the 7th Michigan Infantry was in the front lines of Union forces crossing the Rappahannock River.
Well, let's begin with a refresher about Fredericksburg, how it came to be, its importance in the course of the war.
What happens in the fall of 1862 is that in the days following the Battle of Antietam, which is in September of that year, Abraham Lincoln is frustrated with his Union Army commander, George McClellan. He fires him and puts a new commander in charge. It's Ambrose Burnside. Burnside has a plan, which is to move aggressively on Richmond, and by doing that, he's going to hopefully outflank Robert E. Lee's Confederate Army. The plan requires the Union Army to go to Fredericksburg. Fredericksburg is a town of about 5,000 people. It's an old town, not particularly important in the great scheme of things war-wise. Some roads, canal, et cetera, but it's along the Rappahannock River, which is about 400 feet wide. Burnside will get to Fredericksburg with his army well ahead of Lee. Matter of fact, he steals a march on Lee, so he has surprise on his side. The problem is he doesn't have pontoon bridges to cross the river, and he's not sure what he wants to do. He's reluctant to ford the river or any place, send some of the army cross, so he sits and he waits for the pontoon boats. In the meantime, Lee recovers and arrives at Fredericksburg.
That's where Lee buys some time advantage?
Yeah, I mean, Burnside's concern is that by crossing some of his army on the south side of the river, it might get stranded. It's now November, moving into December. The weather could get bad, so he sits and waits. It's a real fiasco on the part of the Yankees not having the bridges there. It's not Burnside's fault, curiously enough. Clearly, he's going to be blamed for it at some future point, but by not changing his plan as it evolves is really going to come back to haunt the Union Army.
Just a brief aside, sideburns are named for Burnside.
That's true, and I have looked to try to figure out why, and I can't offer a why, but the answer is yes. He had big sideburns. When you think of other people's names and you think, I don't know, but it's true.
He can't be the only man who wore his hair that way.
No, I don't think so. And certainly beards were fashionable in the mid-19th century. And he didn't really have so much a beard as he did have, the big sideburns. But he is credited with offering us the burns, or sideburns, as we understand it, yes.
Well, thanks for indulging me in that aside. So the 11th of December is the date that we have the crossing of the river.
What happens is that the bridges finally arrive, but now the Confederate Army is positioned on the south side of the river. But in the town itself, they've got several hundred Confederate infantrymen, and they're going to make it difficult for the pontooniers to build the bridges to cross the Rappahannock. To build a pontoon bridge, you just have to envision kind of like a series of rowboats. I mean, they're blunt ends on either side of the boat because they're put, they're crosswise, and then you put boards down and you make your way across. It's all done with ropes. There's no nails involved. Well, on the morning of December 11th, the pontooniers come out. They're going to build a series of bridges across the river, and they start in the early morning fog. Well, while there's fog out there, that's fine, but the Confederates are on the city side, and they're waiting. They can hear everything, right? And so as the fog begins to lift, they fire on the pontooniers, who are unarmed, and run away. That's not their job to fight. It's to build bridges. Well, that creates a problem for the Yankees. Along comes the commander of Union artillery, who is a Detroit native, and suggests to General Burnside, we'll just kind of pound them with our guns. We've got several hundred guns on the south side of the river. So during the course of the early morning into the afternoon, they will throw literally thousands of artillery rounds into the city trying to drive those Confederates out. All they'll succeed in doing is creating a lot of rubble where the Confederates can even hide better. So when they finally realize that's not going to work, The artillery officer, General Hunt, says to Burnside, well, why don't we take our guns and provide covering fire for infantrymen who can storm across the river? Burnside says, well, that sounds like a decent idea, but he's a little nervous that it might not work. So he's looking for volunteers.
So these volunteers, who do they wind up being?
Well, curiously enough, while the pontooners have been driven back from their bridges, which are about two-thirds to three-quarters completed, so they're within about 80 feet of the south side of the river, there is a brigade of infantry commanded by Norman Hall. Now, Norman Hall is from Lenawee County, Michigan. He's a West Point graduate. He was at Fort Sumter when the war started, and he will volunteer his brigade. The lead regiment is his old regiment, the 7th Michigan, which is a veteran regiment, has seen action throughout the 1862 in particular, and it will be commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Henry Baxter from Jonesville.
So when we say volunteers, that's a relative term. They were volunteered by their commander, right?
They were volunteered by their commander, and since this crossing works, everyone takes great pride, obviously. Had it failed, maybe there wouldn't have been quite the same recognition of what they were to do. So the 7th Michigan is volunteered, and the way they understand it is that the pontooners will either paddle or pole the boats across the river, and that they will simply be in and maybe fire from the boats or then certainly disembark when they get on the south side. Well, the pontooners have been shot at all day, and they're not all excited at this idea. So they simply, and the record is a little bit unclear, but it looks like most of them ran away and said, if you really want to cross this river, you do it. So the story talks about how the 7th Michigan will actually use their rifle butts to try to paddle across this river, which, again, isn't all that wide, but they are under fire during the course of doing it. During the crossing, several will be wounded, several killed, obviously. By the time this is all over, the 7th Michigan will have suffered 5 killed and 16 wounded, including Henry Baxter, who will be seriously wounded. He'll survive. But when they cross over, then they disembark from their pontoon boats, and the Confederates, according to the Yankee observers, you know, like rats from a hole, you know, suddenly started running. Now, they didn't run all that far. They still stayed and created a bit of a problem for the Michiganians and then subsequent troops who will follow them.
It's my understanding that from the crossing to the end of the battle, so to speak, is a period of several days, 4 or 5 days. Am I right?
Right. And what happens is that when the Yankees take possession of the city, they've driven the Confederates out, and they spend about a day in there. And one of the more embarrassing experiences in the Army of the Potomac is that they will spend time looting the town. There are stories about Yankees dressing in women's clothes. I try not to go there with my students. I'm not quite sure what we're supposed to make of all of that. But then, sadly, the next day, which is December 13th, General Burnside will finally now get his act together, and they will attack the entrenched positions where the Confederates will create all kinds of havoc. I mean, the battle on the 13th is a fiasco for the Yankees. 3 Yankee casualties for every Confederate casualty. Abraham Lincoln, who had hoped for a battle success late in the season. Again, you don't campaign generally in the winter. Emancipation Proclamation will be formalized on the 1st of January. I mean, he's just shocked when he reads the reports going, my gosh, how could this have happened? When the Michiganians arrive on the south side of the river, the Yankees all along, I mean, the thousands of Yankees on the south side of the river have watched what's going on, and there are great cheers that come up from the Yankees as well. And as you might imagine, the actual success that the 7th Michigan and the subsequent soldiers will have leads to great press reports as well. Matter of fact, the New York Herald will call it, quote, a brave and splendid act that justly received the highest praise from the generals and the officers of all the Army. The Michigan boys did it gallantly, and then in a regional boost, the New York Tribune will point out the Western soldiers point the way for victory and say to their Eastern companions in arms, come on, boys, this is the road to Richmond. Again, during the Civil War, Western and Eastern soldiers tended to be somewhat competitive. It may have been, as the Detroit Advertiser and Tribune reported, one of the most brilliant actions of the war, and it certainly was the first river crossing under fire. The legacy, though, beyond all of that, is that it provided the opportunity for Burnside to move his army across the river and the fiasco of December 13th.
Can you give us a comparison of scale, putting Fredericksburg in light of, say, Antietam?
The Yankees will suffer about the same number of casualties at Fredericksburg that they suffered at Antietam. So from that standpoint, it's yet another bloody, indecisive battle. It provides the Confederate Army with even more confidence of just how good or how successful they will be against the Union Army. McClellan they had beaten, Burnside they beat. The next Union commander is a guy by the name of Joe Hooker. They beat him, and all of that leads to the summer of 1863, where Lee says, hey, I can beat anybody who's out there that the Yankees throw at me. That leads to Gettysburg, which, as you know, becomes a terrible Confederate setback. I guess from the standpoint of saying Fredericksburg is just another indecisive, bloody battle.
Mm-hmm.
But if you add them up, if you say, all right, McClellan and Burnside and then Hooker, suddenly Lee's saying, hey, I can beat anybody they throw out there at me. That all comes to a halt at Gettysburg.
One last question then would be, in terms of timeline, what comes after Fredericksburg? What's the next anniversary that we might be observing?
Well, as you might imagine, Burnside, with the fiasco at Fredericksburg, is fired. He's not fired right away. It takes a couple more weeks, but he is replaced by Joe Hooker. And again, armies generally don't campaign during the winter. And we will wait till the spring of 1863, where the Union Army of the Potomac will try to cross the Rappahannock again. They will fail miserably in what becomes one of Robert E. Lee's greatest victories.